Okay, well, as you know, last Sunday we didn't have class because we had the Easter morning breakfast. So this morning we're going to continue with where we were at last time. Now, if you remember back to 2 weeks ago, we went halfway through the notes and then I didn't get to finish. But what I did is I redid the notes for today. So we're going to pick up with exactly where we left off with last time, but on a new section of notes. So if you're keeping notes, I see some of you are logging your notes in a binder or something like that. You'll just have a little bit of overlap between the end of last time and the beginning of this time. What we were talking about was Martin Luther. We started discussing Luther and the Protestant Revolution. And I was going over with you the reasons why I felt that this was more appropriately called a revolution rather than a reformation. And we did that. We looked at the dangerous ideas of Luther. I wrote them up there on the board. We talked about his writings, how he posted 95 theses, and we went through the development of Luther's thinking from early on to later, where he's more early on he's not really saying anything against the church per se, and later on he's definitely being quite openly hostile to the teachings of the Catholic Church. So this morning what I want to do is pick up where we left off. Ideas only cause revolutions if people support them. Okay? If you don't have support for an idea, then the idea is just going to be that, an idea, and it's never going to go anywhere. Okay? So the first point I want to look at with you this morning is the idea that the Germans support the revolution. Okay? The idea, and I'm not going back to reteach a lot of stuff, because if I do, we're never going to get to where we need to be. Okay? So, ideas are only revolutionary if they are embraced by a majority of society. Luther's use of the vernacular language was critical in fostering a revolutionary spirit amongst the common people within Germany. Before 1520, the average press run of a printed book had been about 1,000 copies. So before 1520, any time a book was published on the press, they would usually run 1,000 copies of it, and that was about what they would view as necessary or sufficient. In contrast, printers produced 4,000 copies of Luther's to the Christian nobility and were completely sold out in only a couple of days, with thousands more to follow. Meanwhile, Luther's pamphlets were selling so rapidly, his personal drama is going to rivet all onlookers. So his ideas now are going to be the catalyst, are going to be the thing that's going to put this thing in motion and keep it moving forward. And as I told you last Sunday, or the last time we met, that his writing in the vernacular is the key here, and the printing press then printing and supporting those vernacular writings are the key point that's going to move it forward. Okay? Late in 1520, Pope Leo X issued a decree threatening Luther with excommunication unless he recanted the views expressed in his series of five tracts. On the 10th of December 1520, Luther responded by casting the bull, the papal order, calling for his recantation, all the church laws, onto a roaring fire in front of a huge crowd. So Luther gets the papal bull saying, you either recant or we're going to excommunicate you. And he's in front of an audience outside of Wittenberg there, and he takes it and he throws it on a fire. He basically says, I'll show the Pope what he can do with this blast of wind, and he chucks it on the fire, and then they start feeding the fire with Catholic canon law, and they have basically a big burning. So this is not going to do Luther any favors in terms of how the church is going to view him here, okay? But by this time, it was clear to Roman authorities that Luther was more than a fly-by-night agitator. Papal supporter Jerome Eleander recorded the popular attitude in Germany prior to the Diet of Worms. He wrote, "All Germany is in arms against Rome. All the world is clamoring for a council that shall meet on German soil. Papal bulls of excommunication are laughed at. Numbers of people have ceased to receive the sacrament of penance. Martin is pictured with a halo above his head, and the people kiss these pictures." Okay? So, I mean, yeah, I don't know. He definitely, we have, did you pick up notes?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. So they're definitely, he's definitely now done a lot of things to get the Pope's attention, all right? And it's only a matter of time now. The excitement fanned by a whirlwind of anti-papal pamphlets, okay, a wagon, Eleander mourned, would not hold all of the scurrilous tracts. Luther had clearly captured the hearts and minds of the German populace. So there is so much stuff that is being printed at this point that the church cannot even contain it or really be aware of everything that is being said, done, and printed by Luther against the church. All right, so,
Was the church using the printing press also at this time, or were they still depending upon their own scribes?
Yes, well, they were, because one of the things that Tetzel did is he had, for the first time, the indulgences printed on a press.
Oh, okay.
So to some extent the church was, but the church was still using Latin.
Oh, okay.
And so they actually hate Luther because they view him as fighting unfairly. Okay? Because he's using his sword is his pen, in other words, and he's using the vernacular, and so they're really angry with him because he's not fighting fair, so to speak. Okay? Now, on 11th December 1520, the day after burning of the papal bull, Luther took his final revolutionary step and proclaimed that no man could be saved unless he renounced the role of the papacy. The monk had excommunicated the Pope. Upon receiving words of these events, Pope Leo X excommunicated Luther and released him to his lay overlord, Elector Frederick the Wise, for proper punishment. Instead of burning Luther at the stake, which would have been the customary punishment for heresy, Frederick claimed that Luther had not received a fair hearing and brought him in January 1520 to be examined by a diet of princes of the Holy Roman Empire convening in the city of Worms. So here is a key turning point, okay? Prince Frederick the Wise supports Luther, all right? He does not turn him over to be executed and burned at the stake. He supports him and says he hasn't had a fair hearing, and he appeals to the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire for a hearing. And actually, it's quite the little politician in the way he does this and says, you know, your grandfather promised that no German would ever be tried without a hearing by Germans. And so he manipulates within the law, so to speak, to get Luther a hearing at Worms. Okay? So, the German problem now fell into the hands of the young, newly elected Emperor Charles V, who was under oath to defend the Church and remove heresy from the Holy Roman Empire. As the grandson of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, who are famous for what, by the way? Sending out Columbus. Okay. Charles not only shared his grandfather's desire for a moral reform of the Church, but also her adherence to the doctrines on which the Pope was the guardian. So in other words, is Charles staunchly Catholic? Yeah, he is. He is. He's staunchly Catholic. His grandparents are staunchly Catholic in Spain, and he is sort of going to be viewed here as the protector of the Church within the German states. Okay? So, viewing Catholicism, in case you, it's maybe more clear here, viewing Catholicism as the glue that held his far-flung empire together, Charles had no sympathy for Luther. On the 18th of April 1521, the second day of questioning, after a rough first day, Luther uttered his now famous response in German. Since your majesties and your lordships desire a simple reply, I will answer without distinctions. Unless I am convinced by testimony of sacred scripture or by evident reason, I do not accept the authority of popes and councils, for they have contradicted each other. My conscience is captive to the word of God. I cannot and I will not recant anything, for to go against my conscience is neither right nor safe. God help me. Amen. So, first day, actually, Luther doesn't really do so hot. And he asks for another day. They're not real happy about that, but they grant it to him. And the next day, they have, when he walks into the room at Worms, all of his books are laid on a table, and they go through there. The guy who's leading his trial, so to speak, says, "Will you recant what's in your books?" And he goes, "Well, I can't recant everything that's in my books because all my writings are of a different nature." And of course, that doesn't really make them all that happy, okay? But now possessing no other choice but to officially brand Luther a heretic, Charles V was faced with the prospect of martyring the most popular figure in all Germany. Now, does he want to kill this guy?
Yes.
He wants to, but politically, can he really do it?
Suicide.
No, because if he does, there's going to be massive revolt and, you know, and so forth in the streets if he actually has Luther killed. So, reading on with that point now, fearing public opinion, and knowing that the support of the German princes might lead the revolution, Charles V, with the sanction of the Pope, secured for Luther a safe passage back to Wittenberg. Now, if you remember who else was promised safe passage and conduct to a papal meeting, to a church meeting, who was betrayed by an emperor and was burnt at the stake? John Huss. Okay? Frederick the Wise and some of these other German princes are all too familiar with what happened to Huss. And so despite the fact that the Pope has assured him that he'll have safe passage, they arrange for Luther to be kidnapped. Okay? Despite these promises, Luther's supporters feared that he would face the same fate as John Huss, who was murdered while making a similar journey despite the promises of an earlier emperor. In a piece of superb melodrama, he was kidnapped by a group of bandits and held in captivity at Wartburg Castle from May 1521 to February 1522. Electric Frederick the Wise had pressured the reluctant monk to consent to the kidnapping so that Luther could be protected without Frederick laying himself open to the charge of harboring a heretic. So this is all mastermind here. Luther agrees to it so that the prince that's protecting him can say, I don't know anything about it, and not be putting himself in jeopardy with the Catholic authorities. Okay? So he's kidnapped by his friends, he's hidden away in Wartburg Castle, and he's basically secluded there for a time while other things are going to start to play out here. But this is where Luther is going to end up for over a year, essentially, okay, for quite a while. Any questions about any of this so far?
Well, we've been taught or heard that Luther had nailed his thesis to the door. Is that a wise tale?
No, that's true. That was common standard procedure in the scholarly world of that day to post your ideas on the door, like a bulletin board. He definitely actually did that. While in Wartburg, Luther began making his landmark translation of the New Testament into German, thus implementing his own demand that God's Word be made available to all people. Now, I'm going to say more about that next week. I have a whole point that I've planned out next week just to talk about Luther's German Bible. Okay? So right now, all I want you to know is that it's while he's in exile here in Wartburg Castle that he starts and makes considerable progress on the translation of the New Testament into German. Okay? Meanwhile, on the 22nd of May, 1521, the Diet of Worms issued its official edict. The council ruled that beginning on the 15th of April, 1521, Luther was to have 21 days, after which time no one was to harbor or aid him in any way. Moreover, his followers were condemned, and his books were ordered to be burned anywhere they were found. That shouldn't surprise you. The church has been burning books for thousands of years.
Is that a complete sentence, though? I mean, after Luther was to have 21 days, after which time should there be? He was supposed to give up or something? Was there supposed to be something more to that sentence?
Not a period. It continues on.
Meanwhile,
on
20. Yeah, or aid him in any way. At this point, Luther's hopes of reforming the Catholic Church had been dashed. But there was an alternative, a dangerous, radical, and groundbreaking possibility that was open to Luther. Thanks to his being backed by German princes, he could create a new church and start all over again. Luther's ideas were now being backed by secular principalities and powers, thus providing a formula that would soon lead to violence. Okay? So, now does he at this point, is it abundantly clear that there isn't going to be any reform in the Catholic Church? Okay? He's a heretic. He's been excommunicated. If he's caught up with within this time period, they're going to kill him. And the only other option that he has is to do what? Form a new church. Okay? And now does he have the support of some high-ranking people within Germany who would back him in doing this? Okay? So that's... he's not going to get anywhere here if he doesn't have princes, German princes, that are willing to put their own neck on the line to support him here. Okay? So... while in exile at Wartburg Castle, disguised as a minor nobleman and living under the assumed name Junker George, the revolt against Rome spread without Luther's direct leadership. In town after town, priests and town councils removed statues from the churches and abandoned the Mass. New reforms, many of them far more radical than Luther, appeared on the scene. By far the most critical development during Martin's stay at Wartburg was that German princes, dukes, and electors were defying the condemnation of Luther by giving support to the new movement. Alright, so now they are openly rebellious to the church. Now, if you can remember back to 2 weeks ago when I started the lesson on Luther, remember I told you there were already forces in play within Europe at the time of Luther that were moving towards that made Europe ripe for this revolution to occur here. Okay? And one of them is, again, that these German princes, do they like paying taxes to the Catholic Church? No. So now, are they seeing an opportunity to break away from that? Now, I don't want to be too cavalier about this. Did some of these German princes legitimately believe Luther's teaching? Yes. However, were there some that probably could have cared less one way or the other and were only supporting him because they viewed it to be politically advantageous to themselves? Okay? So you got to understand that you got both things in play here. Just 1 second. But for Luther, he's not all that, at least at this time, too concerned about that as long as the ideas are getting out there and the thing is continuing to move forward. Norm?
Now, is that what you meant when you mentioned secular support?
Yep. No matter how influential, Luther had become within the German populace. His cause surely would have failed had it not been for the decisive intervention and support of constituted political authorities. The authors of their history and culture offer the following insight into this matter. Now, I think this is pretty good. There have been heretics aplenty in Europe before, and we already know who's calling who heretics here. But most of them had died at the stake, as Luther would have done without intervention from Frederick the Wise. And even had Luther lived, spontaneous popular expressions of support alone would have not succeeded in instituting Lutheranism because such could easily have been put down by the power of the state. In fact, although in the early years of the revolt, he was more or less equally popular throughout Germany, only in those territories where rulers formally established Lutheranism, mostly in the German north, did the new religion prevail. Whereas in the other, Luther's sympathizers were forced to flee, face death, or conform to Catholicism. In short, the word of the prince in religious matters was simply law. So you cannot escape the reality here that this is going to go nowhere if these secular princes do not support the movement. Okay? Now that's going to end up somewhere that you don't want it to end up. Because it's ultimately, this new church is once again going to be, its power is once again going to be tied back into the what?
Government.
The state. And what's one of the things that Luther said shouldn't happen when he criticized the Catholic Church originally? Is that you shouldn't have this union of church and state. The church should not be the state. While it's sort of a catch-22, because without the power of these princes behind him, does Luther's movement die? Yeah, But at the same time, are the princes ultimately going to control what's going to happen within the movement? So you have two phenomena here that are, one is good and the other one is bad. So we'll talk more about that also next week. But you have to understand what the forces here that are at work within this situation. The German princes that chose to support Lutheranism did so for a variety of reasons. Some truly believed and embraced the movement's doctrinal teachings. Others did so for their own economic and political gain. In addition, am I missing one?
Yeah.
This thing is doing this every week now where it's taking my things and flipping them, and I can't figure out why. German princes had assembled at the Diet of Augsburg in 1500, so this is before Luther posted his theses, to demand a refund of some of their ecclesiastical dues they had sent to Rome on the grounds that their coffers were being drained. Okay, so that's 1500, okay? 1500, the German princes meet at Augsburg and say to the church, we need some of our money back. How do you think that went? Yeah, go take a hike, right? 1516, Luther does what? Nick, is it 16 or 17? What did I say before? I'm getting all my...
17.
Get my dates confused now. Okay. So, you go back as far as 1500, and now the German prince is already protesting the amount of money they're paying to Rome. Okay? So, back to the notes. As one might expect, these results fell on deaf ears within the Vatican. With the emergence of Lutheranism, many German princes were quick to perceive that if they embraced this new religious movement, ecclesiastical dues would not be sent to support foreigners, and that much of the savings would directly or indirectly wind up in their own bank accounts. So is there economic reason here in the 1520s now to support Luther? Okay? So now I'll go back. In addition to the economic matter of taxation, the larger political issue in the early 16th century was the search for absolute governmental sovereignty. Throughout Europe, the major political trend in the years around 1500 was towards making the state dominant in all walks of life, religious as well as secular. So there's a trending away from the church having absolute power here. Okay? And this is all a part of that stream or that flow of history. As a result, many rulers fought for the right to appoint their own church officials within their own realms, thus limiting the independent jurisdiction of church courts. Consequently, many German princes seized the revolutionary religious ideas of Luther as their chance to assert their political independence from the Catholic Church. So you have a few issues here with the German princes. Some of them are religious. Some of them are doing what they're doing for religious reasons. They agree with Luther. Okay? Some of them are economic. They just want the money, and some of them are what? Political. Okay? While individual religious beliefs no doubt played a part in the power grab, the most common aim was the gaining of sovereignty by naming pastors, cutting off fees to Rome, and curtailing the jurisdiction of the church. In the end, what the German princes were not able to secure through negotiation, they were prepared to wrest by force. Now, remember our definition of a revolution. The transference of power and property in the name of an idea. Okay? Who supplied the ideas?
Luther.
Okay? Is he being supported now by the German princes? The German princes, are they prepared to use force to get all the changes that they want to get? Okay? So, if you look at the next point there, this revolution is now going to turn what? Violent. Okay? Now, before we get into that point, are there any questions? No? All right. initially...
Did I go too far?
Using Barsum's definition of a revolution, Protestantism's primary ideas at this point had been articulated by Luther, embraced popularly, and supported by a plethora of German princes. According to Barsum's revolutionary definition, the situation was about to erupt into violence as power and property were now up for grabs. Commenting on the religious and politically charged situation within Germany, Barsum writes, "An idea newly grasped stirs the blood with aggressiveness. From safe corners such as universities and monasteries, force was called for, and many laymen were not afraid to use it. They quoted Luther, "One must fight for the truth." When possessions were at stake, whether simply threatened or taken over by Protestants, armed conflict was inevitable. Pulpits, churches, and other religious houses, town offices, and privileges that went with all these changed hands. And more than once, local sentiment coupled with power decided ownership. All right? Now, widespread violence.
What is going on with this thing? No, it's not. It should be this one.
Widespread violence swept over Germany with the Peasants' Revolt of 1524 through 1526. The German peasants were the beast of burden for society, and in no better condition than slaves. They were ground down by taxation, legal and illegal, a condition that would only worsen after the discovery of America and the rapid increase of wealth and luxury that followed. Long before the Protestant Revolution, revolutionary outbreaks took place in various parts of Germany, only to end as disastrous failures as they were put down by brute force. So, 1524 now to 1526, you're going to have what's called the Peasants' Revolt. Had peasants revolted a lot before that?
That's the point. Yeah, they had. But the difference, though, between revolts before this and this one is that was there a unified church to squash the rebellion?
Yeah. But now, is the church split? Okay? So even this revolt now, so what the peasants are going to do is they're going to use the ideas of Luther now to justify what? Revolt and rebellion. All right, against any form of political authority. I have no idea what is going on with this thing. So let's just forget it and use the notes. Sorry about that. We're on page 4, about halfway down. In 1524, German peasants... we did that? Did we do that one?
No.
In 1524, German peasants excited by talk of freedom... and mistaking spiritual liberty for carnal freedom, demanded an end to serfdom. Bands of angry peasants went throughout the countryside, raiding monasteries, pillaging, and burning them to the ground. In addition, the peasants also demanded the right to choose their own clergy, be paid by their rulers for extra services performed, and claim rights of land ownership. Now, I don't care whether you're a Protestant prince or a Catholic prince, do you want the peasants doing that? New. Okay? So what's going to happen? These Lutheran princes and these Catholic princes are all going to agree about one thing, and the one thing they're going to agree about is none of them want that. Okay? So, initially, next point, Luther supported the peasants. However, he turned against them when Thomas Munzer massacred the inhabitants of Weinsberg and burned castles and churches. In a venomous tract, Luther urged the German princes to use whatever means necessary to put down the revolt. In response, both Protestant and Roman Catholic princes united their forces against a common enemy and successfully put down the rebellion, slaughtering over 100,000 peasants in the process. Okay? Now, isn't it fascinating that the Catholic princes are now taking orders from Luther? Luther writes, hey, princes, you got to put down this rebellion. And the Catholics say, okay, let's go do it. And they side up with these Lutherans to squash the peasants' revolt. And they kill over 100,000 peasants in the process. Probably unnecessarily. Okay? They didn't need to do that to end the revolt.
Now, Luther, behind what he was thinking, is that he didn't intend to have war with his, right? I mean, he's not on the side of political or economic or, well, religious, but that's all, right? I mean,
Luther is appalled. He's appalled by the initial revolt. But then he's equally appalled by the means that the princes used to stop the rebellion.
So he's
appalled that the peasants rebel in the first place, and the massacre and the devastation and destruction that they inflict, and then he calls for the princes to intervene. But when he gets out of prison and he sees what the princes have done, then he's equally appalled by that as he was, you know, with the thing in the beginning.
I wonder if he was kind of depressed. Was it widely known that he had written this to encourage the revolt to be?
It was fairly widely known, yeah, that the whole thing went away that he never wanted it to go.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay? Because he wasn't calling for violent revolution. But you got to put yourself in the mindset of a peasant. Do you have any rights?
No.
Here's this guy talking about the freedom of a Christian, talking about fighting for the truth, so on and so forth, and they use that as their reason for rebelling against the political authorities.
Well, we get that in our revolution too.
Oh, of course.
They're doing it today in Libya and in Syria. The peasants have arisen against them. Right? For political reasons.
Yeah. Luther, let's see here. So here you have the next point. Luther responded to the carnage by calling the nobility devils for their brutality, but the damage had been done. The ultimate result was that Luther lost the trust of those he had initially sought to help him with his reforms. Despite losing much of his popular support, many northern German princes continued to support Lutheranism. Okay? The temporary truce between Protestants and Catholics did not continue after the end of the Protestant rebellion. Big surprise, right? It would not be long before religious antagonism would erupt into full-scale war. Germany would witness 23 years of war with sporadic breathing spells as two unstable leagues of princes, Protestant and Catholic, sought to establish the dominance of their own faith and governmental power. Even though that edict issued at Worms in 1521 was binding, Charles V was too preoccupied with wars in France and Italy to enforce its ruling. Okay? So, in other words, is Luther getting a pass? Is Luther still, if at any time, could the church have decided to enforce the edict and kill him?
Yeah.
Okay? But he's being protected to some extent, okay? He's living in safety, the relative safety of the northern German states, where there are princes that support him, okay? In the years following Worms and preceding the outbreak of open hostilities, the German princes had begun arranging themselves on one side or the other, with northern Germany primarily supporting Lutheranism, while the southern states remained loyal to Rome. In 1524, papal legates succeeded in organizing a league of Roman Catholic princes in southern Germany. In 1526, the first Diet or Spear convened to consider the demands of the Catholics that the Edict of Worms should be enforced and the counterproposals of the Protestants that religion be left free until a general council under German auspices should adjudicate the disputes. So again, even these Lutherans here, ultimately they're saying, what? Well, we got to have a council to decide this. Now, is that what Luther would have said? Not if we go back to his dangerous ideas we talked about last week, where he says that the final authority is only what? It's only Scripture. So here you got the politics now involved, and they're saying, well, we got to have a council We got to have a meeting to decide the issue. The council ruled that pending the findings of future diets, each German state and religion should so live, rule, and bear itself as it thought it could answer to God and the emperor. Furthermore, it was decided that no one should be punished for past offenses against the Edict of Worms, and that the Word of God should be preached by all parties, none interfering with the others. The revolutionaries interpreted this recess of Speer as sanctioning the establishment of Lutheran churches, the religious autonomy of each territorial prince, and the prohibition of the Mass in Lutheran areas. While the Catholics rejected these assumptions, Charles V was too preoccupied with other matters to do much about the situation. Yeah.
You say the emperor, you said the emperor a couple times previous. Are you talking about the Pope? Are you talking about the German emperor?
Charles V. Who was, by the way, put in power by who? By the Pope. In February 1529, having settled the majority of his foreign distractions, Charles V ordered that the Diet of Speer be reconvened. Possessing a Catholic majority, the Second Diet of Speer repealed the recess of 1526 and passed a decree permitting Lutheran services but requiring the toleration of Catholic services in Lutheran states while completely forbidding Lutheran preaching in Catholic states, thus enforcing the Edict of Worms. Okay? You following that? On the 25th, yeah.
Basically, got local governmental authorities deciding which church is going to be.
Well, now you get the council with the emperor presiding, and he says, okay, this is a simple breakdown. Okay?
He basically provides state rights.
No,
I wouldn't go that far.
In the north is primarily what?
Lutheran.
The south is predominantly what?
Catholic.
So what they're doing, the Second Diet of Speer, is saying, okay, you Lutherans, you can practice that up there, but you got to make allowances for what? For the Mass. In the meantime, the Catholics down here in the south are not mandated to make allowances for who to worship?
Lutherans.
So the Catholics use their majority power to try to enforce now the Edict of Worms from 1521. Okay? So they're going to allow these northern states to practice Lutheranism openly, but they're also mandating that they allow the what?
Mass.
The Mass. Meanwhile, in the Catholic states of the south, they're obviously not going to allow what? The Lutheran service. So the Lutherans are going to view that and say what?
It's not fair.
Okay? And it, well, obviously it wasn't, okay? But has the church done anything that's been fair? In 1530, the religious and political situation within Germany was an absolute mess. Philip Schopp offers the following assessment of the situation. The Diet of Speer had forbidden the further progress of the Reformation. The Edict of Worms was in full legal force. The emperor had made peace with the Pope and received from him the imperial crown of Bologna? Bologna? Whatever. Bologna. It's all Bologna anyway, so. The Protestants were divided amongst themselves. At the conference at Marburg, had failed to unite them against the common foe. Now, we'll talk about that too. That was a meeting between Luther and Zwingli, the Swiss reformer. Okay? There was a movement to try to get the Lutherans and the Swiss reformers on the same page so that they would have a more united front against the Catholics, but Luther and Zwingli could not agree on the issue of communion and the Lord's Supper. Okay, we'll talk about that next week. But anyway, at this point, they failed to come up with any sort of arrangement. At the same time, the whole empire was menaced by a foreign power. The Turks, which are the Muslims, under Suleiman, had reached the summit of their military power and approached the gates of Vienna in September 1529. So this is a total mess. Okay, Germany is divided. The Protestants are divided amongst themselves now between Lutheran and Reformed. Okay, Because Zwingli and Luther are not able to come to any kind of a terms or agreement with each other. And in the meantime, all the Christian world is having the Turks march against them, and they're nearing, closing in on Vienna, Austria, as of, what was the date there? 1529. So, not only is the Reformation in a state of flux, if you want to call it that, but the entire eastern half of the Christian world at this time is under serious threat to Muslim armies. Okay? Under these circumstances, the Diet of Augsburg convened on the 8th of April 1530. Its objective was to settle the religious question and to prepare for war against the Turks. Knowing the hour and the score, Charles asked the Protestants to put forth their beliefs in writing and demonstrate where they differed from the Roman Catholic Church. The resulting document became known as the Augsburg Confession, which was henceforth regarded as the official presentation of the Lutheran position. Now, if you were in the Lutheran Church, you probably know about this, right?
Is that the same one with GBC?
I don't remember. What do you mean? Study?
Bible classes. We had to learn confession. I can't remember which one it was.
I don't. Probably wasn't this one. I wouldn't think. But you know, I don't know for sure. You can go online and read this confession. Okay, just search Augsburg Confession, and you can read every last word of it if you want to.
Why is it called a confession?
Confession is just that's an early Reformation term. We would call it a doctrinal statement today. It's essentially the same thing. We believe this. Confession is profession. This is what we profess that we believe, in other words.
I think we can we get from this how our Lord looks? You know, in history, it seems it's a mess. But through this mess, you know, through these wars, even, these confessions come where you can have and you can read and discuss, and you know, isn't it fascinating? Kind of like, I mean, but it's not a clean issue. I mean, if Luther probably in his mind says you're going to stand and look what it's produced, but what's come out of it is the Reformation, which is that's why we're here, right? I mean, so can we learn something about how God works in the world today? That's what I'm thinking.
God works in the world today through His Word working in believers. So to the extent that Luther stands up for that truth and that Word, you can say it's God working. To the extent that man agrees with that and stands up for that truth and that truth works in him, I think you can say it's God working. I don't think you can say that God works in the mind of Charles V, the Catholic Emperor of Spain, to get him to do A, B, or C. Other than the extent of the courage of the believer to stand up. I mean, let's face it. What these guys do in drafting this confession, it is a courageous act because they easily could have been strung up in the street right after they presented it. Okay? And you read the Augsburg Confession and there's quite a few things in it that you and I would agree with. Okay? But, again, not all of it, but to the extent that they stand up for truth and to the extent that standing up for truth causes a recognition, I think you can say, yeah, that's God working.
And the same process would happen today.
Well, we've already studied,
yeah,
haven't we, how there have always been people that never were a part of the Catholic Church, that never adapted or accepted papal authority and all those sorts of things. And, I mean, that's why, so there's always been those believers that were not willing to do that and who were willing to stand for the Word and not tradition, councils, and, you know, and all that sort of thing. And even these Protestant confessions, they're going to become for the Protestants what they were for the Catholics, because now you go into a Reformed church and you ask if they're able to think outside of that confessional statement.
That's why it's called a confession.
Yeah, you are bound, if you're going to be in that denomination, you are bound to the terms of the confession. And even if you go to a Reformed church today or in some Lutheran churches, they cannot get away from that type of confessional thinking in how they view themselves as a denomination. Okay? So
they're not going to like that if they're coming in to ask questions.
And they don't like that kind of stuff.
No.
Where are we again? Oh, yeah. Now, somebody's going to have to help me out with this guy's name. The document was drafted by who?
Melanchthon.
Who?
Melanchthon.
Melanchthon. Okay. That guy, a student of Luther's, who being under imperial ban was not present at the meeting. So, Luther's not going to go to the meeting. Okay? His right-hand man here, the guy's name starts with an M, he's going to draft the confession, and then the German princes that are in agreement are going to go to Augsburg to present the confession. But Luther does not go. Okay? Because if he leaves where he's at, he's very probably going to be killed. Alright? So, despite being absent from the Diet, Melanchthon, right? Consulted his teacher and composed a two-part treatise outlining the articles of faith which Lutherans and Catholics share in common, as well as those that were unique. The Swiss portion of the empire, being followers of Zwingli, refused to sign the Augsburg Confession and submitted their own document. Charles V attempts to reconcile the views of the revolutionaries with Catholic rebuttals failed. As a result, the Roman Catholic majority claimed that the Protestants had been refuted, resulting in Charles' decree that they had until April 1531 to submit to papal authority. Okay? Unwilling to capitulate, the Lutheran princes met at Schmalkalden, I guess, and formed a defensive league, which bore the name of the town in which it was formed. Over the next 23 years, Germany existed in a state of almost constant warfare as leagues of Catholics and Protestants sought to establish their own political and religious dominance. In 1532, a temporary truce was struck between Charles V and the Schmalavecan League in order to defend the region against the Turkish invasion. However, during the intermittent time, Protestantism continued to spread throughout the empire. When conferences between Protestants and Catholics held in 1540 and 1541 at Charles V's request failed to bring peace, the emperor sought to eradicate Protestantism from within the borders of the empire and restore imperial obedience within Germany. In order to accomplish this goal, Charles declared under the ban Philip of Hesse and Electric John Frederick of Saxony, the nephew and successor of Frederick the Wise, who had aided Martin Luther. In the ensuing war, both Protestant princes were defeated and imprisoned, and Protestantism appeared to have been destroyed. So eventually this gets to the point where the Catholics just try to wipe it off the map. Okay? In actuality, the revolutionaries were far from being snuffed out, as large portions of the populace still embraced Luther's teachings. When war broke out again this time, the Protestant princes were aided by the King of France, who was awarded the border cities of Metzel, Toul, and Verdun for his support in the revolutionary cause. With French strength behind them, the Protestants defeated Charles V's forces and nearly captured him in 1552. Arms and circumstances so favored the Protestants that they demanded everything. They demanded everything. They were to be free in the practice of their faith in all German territory. Catholic worship was to be forbidden in Lutheran territory. Present and further confiscation of church property were to be held valid and Okay. Now, the resulting Peace of Augsburg was established on the 25th of September, 1555, and rested on the notion, there's the Latin term, but as the ruler, so the region. Religion. Which meant that in those principalities where Lutheran princes ruled, Lutheranism would be the sole state religion, and the same for those with Catholic princes. So what determined the religion of an area? The religious beliefs of that prince. This is what they agree on. Thus, in order to permit peace among and within the states, each prince was to choose between Roman Catholicism and Lutheranism. In addition, all one's subjects were expected to embrace the religion of their of their realm or emigrate. So if you lived in a particular area your whole life and you were Lutheran and a Catholic prince was ruling that region, and you wanted to practice, you had to move. You had to move into a different area, principality, with a prince that was favorable to your religious viewpoint.
But like Sweden, I think Sweden never had a war. Between the Catholic that they were all, you know, Lutheran.
Yeah, and in the 30 Years' War, which comes about 100 in the 1516. First half of the 1600s, the Swedes are going to fight on the side of the Protestants in the 30 Years' War.
My dad talked about that. I wish I would have listened.
He always talked
about that.
Yeah, and the 30 Years' War is another interesting thing because that's the time when Louis XIII is running France. And if you know anything about Louis XIII was a weak king. And the Catholic Cardinal Richelieu was practically running France for Louis XIII. Okay? That's where the stories of the Three Musketeers, you know, come into play. And Richelieu's always a bad guy in all the stories, right? Okay? Well, Richelieu is a Catholic. He's a Catholic cardinal. But in the 30 Years' War, he takes Catholic France and puts Catholic France on the side of the Protestants against the Holy Roman Empire, because if just think about the geography here. I just told you that if Germany's here, France is here, this is all relative, okay? Spain is down here. It's not an accurate map, all right? I just told you that Henry V, the Holy Roman Empire, was related to who?
Spain.
Who's in the middle? France. So, the reason Richelieu, a Catholic, fights on the side of the Protestants is because he views it in his own political advantage to get rid of Catholic what? Germany. So is Richelieu fighting out for religion or fighting for his own personal exaltation of France? You follow what I'm saying? And maybe I hope I'm explaining it well. I'm thinking it. So he's a Catholic who's every bit as much of a politician as the next guy, and he decided it's better for me if I fight on the side of these Protestants, who, by the way, ultimately win the 30 Years' War, okay? And who comes off smelling like a rose? France. And so Louis XIII is going to be replaced by Louis XIV, the Sun King, the great absolute monarch of France, who's going to build France into the most powerful nation on continental Europe. Because Richelieu picked the right side. See, all this stuff has implication down the line. Okay? Everything we're talking about here, it's not like it's happening in a vacuum and it doesn't have any meaning to anything else. And so Gustavus Adolphus, the great king of Sweden, comes down and whoops up. When the Swedes enter the 30 Years' War, it's the turning point. Because the Habsburgs, who are running Catholic Germany, that's the same family that's running Spain down here, and so France intervenes. The war does not turn until the Swedes come down and help their fellow Lutherans against the Catholics. Okay? Now, if you want to know all the details of that, get the book. All right? That book I wrote on this explains all this. At the top of the page, we have just enough time to finish this up.
I just don't see why God isn't... I mean, you say it's a natural result of people either obeying the word or... But boy, Brian, isn't it? I mean, it's so interesting. But It's up to grabs. I don't know.
But what, you're gonna see though, Linda, that a Protestant win is not necessarily a win for the truth. You look at Luther's initial stuff, and I can look at it and I can agree with all of it, just about. Almost all of it. But the problem is, once that those views get institutionalized by a new religious system with the power of a different state behind it, they end up in the same mess that the one they just broke away from is in.
Even Luther says, call no man a Lutheran.
So, while there are certain ways you can definitely view this as a step forward, we cannot take all of it as positive. Okay? Because next week I'm going to talk to you about Luther's German Bible, Luther himself, what kind of guy was Luther? Okay? And Zwingli and the early Swiss Reformation. Then the week after that, I'm going to talk to you about Calvin. And the week after that, I'm going to talk to you about the Anabaptists. And how the Lutherans and the Reformers, they all adopt infant baptism. They adopt it as necessary as part of their salvation process. And so, how are they any different fundamentally than the Catholics? And then both the Catholics and the Protestants are going to slaughter the Anabaptists because the Anabaptists don't agree with them about water baptism.
Right. What's Anna mean?
To baptize again is what the word means. So the Anabaptists are going to take what you and I would recognize probably as a traditional Baptist standard, modern Baptist standpoint, is you shouldn't baptize anybody unless they're old enough to give clear proclamation and testimony of faith in Jesus Christ. Well, that goes against the Catholic view and the Reformed view, so they're going to get it from both sides. All in the name of Christ. Okay? Let's finish these last two points. As such, the Peace of Augsburg was a historical milestone, inasmuch as Catholic rulers for the first time acknowledged the legality of Protestantism. Okay? However, it bode ill for the future in assuming that no sovereign state larger than a free city could tolerate religious diversity. Moreover, in excluding Calvinism, it ensured that Calvinists would become aggressive opponents of the status quo, a reality that would always make the Peace of Augsburg tenuous at best. And the last point, the real winner was not freedom of worship, but the freedom of the princes. Each became like Henry VII of England, the supreme head of the church in his territory, with the exclusive right to appoint clergy and the men who should define the obligatory faith. It was the princes, not the theologians, who had led Protestantism to its triumph. They naturally assumed the fruits of victory, their territorial supremacy over the emperor and the ecclesiastical supremacy over the church. There can be little doubt that Protestantism fits Barsum's definition of a revolution. Luther and the theologians had articulated the ideas, while the political authorities transferred power and property in the name of the theologians' ideas. All right, any questions or comments about... Now, I got to be honest with you, okay? When I was in Bible college, I did not get this understanding of the Reformation. It was not until I went out on my own and looked into these things for other reasons that I fully understood what all the issues were and the forces pulling the Reformation. Yeah.
Now, was the Lutheran Church looking to levy taxes like the Catholic Church? I mean, and use it for their source, or was this a gain for the state?
What that last point I read is basically what it ends up with. We'll talk about this next semester. When Henry VIII breaks away He becomes head of the Anglican, the Church of England, the Anglican Church. So now the Pope's not the head of the Church, the King is the head of the Church. Well, that's essentially what you have here. In each individual German city-state or principality, that prince now becomes the head of the Church in that spot. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, we got to quit. Thanks for your attention. Next week, we will continue by looking at Luther's Bible, and Zwingli. Thank you.